je vous présente Reynos Papadopoulos, qui nous parle depuis Londres. On va parler en anglais. Reynos, I don't know if you heard our little talk. Okay. So the main point that I was trying to discuss is the notion of involuntary dislocation that you analyze so brilliantly in your book. Perhaps we could start with certain differences between involuntary dislocation, exile, refugee, and all these other terms that we touched on. So first of all, in order to attach it to the Odyssey, would you say that Ulysses is an involuntary dislocated person?
Indeed, I would say so. We start from the beginning, don't we? Does he want to go to Troy in the first place? And Homer is teasing us with the whole complexity there. Is he crazy or is he not crazy? And we're asking ourselves, is it crazy to go to the war? Or what is crazy, to go to the war or not to go to the war?
I will just interrupt to explain that beginning. C'est un début qui n'est pas vraiment dans l'Odyssée. Il est implicite, le fait que Ulysse ne veut pas aller à la guerre des Troie et il fait semblant d'être fou et de conduire ses bœufs dans les champs. Et un autre grec qui est plus ingénieux, plus malin que Ulysse, met son bébé Télémaque sur la terre et Ulysse arrête les bœufs pour ne pas l'écraser. Et comme ça, c'est la preuve qu'il n'est pas fou, donc il doit aller en guerre. Mais c'est un peu un catch-22, no? If you're crazy, yeah.
That is the first catch-22. Homer is presenting us with that from the beginning, yes. So is it voluntary for Odysseus to go to Troy in the first place? Then, of course, he wants to go home, but then he wants to go home in a very kind of over-concretized way. And then what Homer is helping us to understand is the complexity of home. Does he mean really home, Ithaca? Or does he refer to other complexities of what is really home? Because if we take the word nostos, for example, where nostalgia comes from, nostos in Homeric language means returning home, okay? So the etymological connection of nostos with nous, nous, noetic, etc., means, well, what does it mean? Does it as they, you know, in Greek context, it is not just only the intellect, but it is the totality of what makes a human being a human being. It is the heart, it is the mind, it is the intellect, it is the emotions, it is the totality. So when we're talking about nostos, we're talking about a recreation of a person, of a renewal of a person's totality of what it means to be human being. Not only new ideas or new intellect, but also new emotions, the totality of being a human being. So if we see it like that, in a sense, the adventures, so to speak, of Odysseus are also a blessing to be that is offered to him in order to develop his own personality, his own being, to enlarge and enrich his whole understanding of being a human being. So in that sense, again, yes, again is the complexity. He wants to go home, but in a sense, he is enriched along the way with so many different experiences. And then, of course, the most teasing part of Homer is that he arrives home. Of course he arrives home. But does he arrive home? According to a usual understanding, a kind of a linear story, we would expect that Odysseus arrives in Ithaca at the end of the poem, and then everything goes wonderful, and then he embraces his wife, and there are violins in the background, and there is a lovely sunset, and there is a Hollywood ending. Of course, it's not like that. He arrives exactly in the middle of the poem, which in a sense, Homer is challenging us to question what is home, because physically he arrives in Ithaca. Beautifully, he puts it that he's not even aware that that is Ithaca. Mm-hmm. And it's missed. When he arrives in Ithaca, when he's washed on the on the shores, he is not even aware that that is Ithaca. So he's been traveling for 10 years to go home, and he arrives and he doesn't even know that it is home to begin with. Then he needs to reconnect with the home. So it's not just the arrival, it is the reconnection. So it takes another, you know, it's in the middle of the poem, so it takes another half of the poem, so to speak, to help us understand the struggles to reconnect with home. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we have more or less the kind of external odyssey to arrive home and another odyssey to reconnect with home. We can easily say something external, something psychological, but I don't think it's just psychological, it's also philosophical, it's also spiritual, it's existential.
And practical, because he has to deal with the complexities of the suitors of Penelope, and of the maids who he has to kill because they betrayed, and it's a political situation.
So going back to your original question, yes, I think the idea of involuntary dislocation in terms of Odysseus helps us to understand the complexities that, to be very concrete, when migrants and refugees come to Europe, are they arriving home? What is their home? Home is where they come from, but it's also it's here. And home is also the journey. As you correctly quoted Cavafy, home is the journey. So we are educated, we're taken through in Odyssey to be transformed along the way. And in order not to be over-concretizing home, that home is this or home is that. Mm-hmm. Often we see in the work that people do with refugees is to sort of make them feel at home by giving them, creating conditions so that they can understand their culture, etc. But also it is, home is also for them to expand and connect with our culture. So that kind of crude over-concretization that home is this or home is that is something that the Odyssey is helping us to grow away from.
Reynos, can you give us an example in your experience? Can you, without betraying confidences, a concrete example of one person that you met who is our Ulysses today?
Well, in a sense, all of them are, because they are torn between all of these different
narratives. Give us one example, with, if we can understand some details of what happens.
Yes, well I'm thinking of actually somebody about that I have written recently about, that I called Abed, that's not his real name, he's from Afghanistan, and he was an interpreter there, and then he came to the UK, to the United Kingdom, and he needed to have some kind of substance of his own story. The important thing is that all the various agencies and organizations and services that he connects with they, in effect, they co-construct a narrative story about him. In other words, that what they want from him is that he is somebody who is damaged, who is traumatized, that they can help. So they emphasize only that part. And in that sense, he sort of co-creates a kind of an identity, a kind of a passport, a narrative passport that I call it, that is based exclusively on his suffering. Nothing about his exuberance of the excitement of coming across new life, new ways of being, discovering new aspects of himself. None of these things. Nobody's interested in that. They want to have a damaged person so that they can help. So this is that kind of the oversimplification that we see, that for me, the Odyssey stands against. The Odyssey reminds us that things are not so oversimplified. And for me, it starts from the beginning with the idea of what is Homer, at the beginning, fairly at the beginning of the epic, describes home, and if you'll allow me, I will recite it in Homeric language. Ie menos ke kapnon, apothros kondan oise, thaneisi mirete geis. That's the part that says he's hoping to see the smoke rising out of his land, mm-hmm. and he will die. That's what he wanted to see. Homer is not talking about either a house or about a country. He's trying to grasp the ungraspable complexity of home through the two polarities, smoke that is untouchable and land. Mm-hmm. He's not talking, I see my house or my palace, yeah. my land, the yeah. soil.
Yeah.
So on the one hand is the most firm soil, concreteness, and on the other is the most ethereal. And home is the complexity between these two polarities. And I think that helps us from the beginning not to over-concretize with people. In the context of Abbott, he has been, in working with me, he has been able to try to validate a lot of principles, ideas, memories from the past and weave them creatively with his present. And not to say past, present, future, because past, present, future, as we know from T.S. Eliot and from experience, these are illusory, they are not concrete entities. They are constructivist ideas. So, I mean, I can go on. Perhaps you can ask me something else.
Please go on. Yeah. But I would be very interested, I think the audience would be interested, to talk about more concrete things that also, that you do work as a psychoanalyst, not only with displaced people, but also with the people who help the displaced people. What are the different aspects of this work?
Well, on the basis of what I have said, I think one of the most difficult, the biggest difficulty is the over-concretization of these situations. So that we lose the complexity. Usually what I say is that the first victim, the first casualty of being a refugee is complexity. People lose complexity, and because they connect with organizations that expect concrete things, they over-concretize things, and we make monodimensional human beings. So, for example, the whole idea of tell me your story. Which story?
Yeah, that's the Odyssey. The Odyssey is exactly that. Tell me your story. It's told 20 times and always different.
Exactly. The expectation with these services is that it is as if a story is something like this, like a pencil. Give me your story, here it is. It's not like that.
Yes. Yes.
It's not like that. So the idea of understanding, and you mentioned it earlier in your presentation, there is no clear coherence because it cannot be. It's a cluster of feelings, images, fears, expectations, beliefs, a whole lot of a cluster that people are struggling to make sense of. And what we should be there is to help them construct that in their own and not to impose our own way of constructing a neat narrative that fits into the model of our own helping professions and our own systems of care in our own countries. You need to emphasize your trauma so that you can get assistance or benefits. If you do not do that, don't tell us about other things. We're not interested in that.
Yes.
So we deprive them of being human beings. We do not help them to reconstruct themselves as human beings. And we expect some kind of neat story that fits into the boxes of our own caring systems. That is, for me, one of the biggest problems. And the example of Abbott that I gave you is that how gradually I helped him to bear his own contradictions and be able to reconstruct two and three and four and different stories of himself for him without me settling and saying, this is your story or that is your story, but for him to find that space to be able to reconstruct himself on his own. And what has actually happened is that helped him to begin to develop a kind of a reflective attitude so that he started actually writing his reflections. Mm-hmm. And I even encouraged him to write his reflections, but it came from him and I validated the value of that and I asked him to do more of that. And then after that, to cut the long story short, he even started writing poetry. Oh. And that it was a person who never read poetry in his life before.
Yes.
But in appreciating the value of putting things together, not in a logical and coherent sequence, but allowing the totality of his being to participate in this reconstruction of himself, that involuntary dislocation offers the opportunity for people to do, he was able to develop, first he started writing a journal and then remembering various things illogically, etc. And then that started writing poetry and he ended up teaching young people poetry classes.
How wonderful, how wonderful. Reynos, before we go on, because I want you to talk a little bit about different kinds of people with different kinds of problems who are displaced. You yourself have had, if not a displaced person's itinerary, your life was one of displacement. So can you tell us a little bit about that, just to give the background of what you do?
Well, myself, I'm Greek Cypriot. I was born in Cyprus. I studied with a UNESCO scholarship in Yugoslavia in the 60s. And then after that, I taught at the University of Cape Town in South Africa for 10 years during the apartheid years. And then I've been in the UK since 1980. So I've lived in different countries. Specifically, I was not a refugee as such, but I moved on. And again, the question is, what is voluntary and what is involuntary? There was no university in Cyprus at the time, so I wanted to go to university, so I had to go abroad. So is that voluntary or involuntary? And again, you know, the idea that I introduced the term involuntary dislocation is to problematize the dimension of voluntariness, because usually that is confused. Yeah. In our crude terminology that we use, a migrant is somebody who wants to go whereas a refugee is not. Well, I mean, how many migrants really want to leave home?
Yes.
You mentioned somebody you are talking with. Actually, I was working in Mexico, just before the pandemic, and I was at the border of Mexico with Guatemala, and I was talking with the kids who are coming from Central America.
Yes.
And they are saying that they used to live comfortably in their homelands, with a little patch of land, cultivating something. Then later, so that you and me get cheap coffee in our supermarkets in Europe, it has become not viable for them to continue. So they needed to go away from home in order to survive. And if it was a 13-year-old kid, and he's the oldest, he goes into another country to support his family.
Yeah.
Is that voluntary? We call them migrants. But I mean, how voluntary is that? And I think it's important for us to problematize these kind of crude definitions that we have about refugees, migrants, et cetera, and question more the complexities of these issues. And going back to the Odyssey that you very ably introduced today, it helps us always to problematize all of these issues.
Good. Before we go on further, since you mentioned South Africa, there is involuntary dislocation within one country. In Africa, with the apartheid, you experienced that. So what did that teach you? What did you see there in South Africa?
Well, again, that problematizes the issue of what is home, because if your own home, and since I have done a lot of research in different countries, if in your own home they make you not feel at home, in effect, you are involuntarily dislocated.
Right.
So, whereas when we're talking about forced migration, we're talking about being forced by violence from one geographical location to another, we have, as we know, we have many examples of people who remain in their own houses, in their own lands, but they don't feel that they are their own anymore.
Right.
And we have, I don't know, Palestinians in Israel, we have Greek Cypriots in the north, Turkish occupied. We have many people in different parts of the world, as well as it was in South Africa, where a lot of people were in their own land. They didn't migrate, but in effect, they were involuntarily dislocated because their own experience of experiencing their own land, safe land, as home was taken away from them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So involuntarily. So that's where I introduced the term involuntary dislocation, and many people find it useful because it problematizes the whole of this sphere. And it is not just simply when you leave your own country in terms of geographical location.
Yeah,
you can still be in your own country, and you don't feel that you are that is your home anymore, because of a change of a regime or an oppressive regime or all sorts of different other restrictions. So I think, that for me in South Africa, it was a very powerful experience, seeing people in their own land feeling that they have been made, in effect, involuntarily dislocated.
Right.
Dislocated not from their physical home, but from their experience of being at home.
Of course, which is part of the problem in the Ukraine today.
Of course.
Yeah, they are made to feel that they don't belong. But in the Odyssey, just to go back to the book we were discussing, there are different forms in which Odysseus is being made to feel displaced, dislocated. For instance, Calypso wants him to feel at home with her, and he doesn't, and he says it very clearly, it is not his home. But he could have felt at home in Alcyone's court So it's very interesting what you pointed out, that all these different notions that you are not at home come to a head when he comes home and he still doesn't know that he is at home. So what is the question? What is home? What is home for a displaced, dislocated person?
The home is the ability to deal with these complexities. And it is not a physical, geographical place, as the Odyssey tells us. And you mentioned the idea that when he arrives, Tiresias told mm-hmm. him, you know, even when you get there, and as we know that there is that version, that of course he doesn't stay in Ithaca, but he goes on. And you know that beautiful image that Tiresias says to him, take an oar.
Yes.
For rowing, yes. You know, take an oar with you.
Yes.
And walk as far from sea as possible.
Yes.
And what if you find people who do not recognize that as an oar, but they will think that it's something that, you know, it's an agricultural.
And they don't have salt, don't eat their food with salt.
Exactly, exactly. In other words, where there is no possibility any longer for further adventures, but actually you can settle, then you can settle. Which is actually an interesting puzzle, because is there any place where they will never recognize that? So it's leaving that with us to sort of consider the complexity that home is not the one position or the other. There is an impulse for exploration and abandoning the familiar in order to explore more, mm-hmm. but it's also there is an impulse for going back to something familiar.
Yes.
And actually, Barbara Cassin talks about planalgia.
Yes.
Planalgia, not only nostalgia, which is returning home, but an impulse for wandering and exploring further.
Yes.
And home is containing both the impulse to wander and explore, as well as the impulse to go for the familiar and the settled. If we go for only for the one,
yeah,
we're destroying that complexity, and then we are oversimplifying things, and then things will go wrong. Either wandering too much and not returning, or staying too static and falling into entropy.
In terms of Jungian psychology, you can tell us a little about the archetype of the wanderer and the archetype of the cynics who would stay at home. Can you tell us a little bit about
this? Yes, exactly. I think, you know, Jung is talking about individuation virtually as an instinct. In other words, by that he means the development of a personality, the development of a person to find the uniqueness of what it is to be me, and not just simply to be somebody else who goes to university, does this, you know, learns, you know, gets a house, gets a mortgage, has kids, etc., what everybody does, but what is the meaning of that for me as an individual? And so the idea of individuation is not to be divided, but to, so it's not just simply individualistic, but to be individuated is to find the uniqueness and the unique meaning of my own being. And in a sense, that is the external exploration, but also the internal reflection and the juxtaposition of these two all the time. If one goes too much on the one, it's not enough. If one becomes too stagnant, or cynic, as you say, you know, the old man sitting and, you know, with the familiar, with the comfortable, then there is no exploration. So both need to be there in a measure, but of course there is no recipe about that, and everybody needs to discover that on their own terms, in their own way, with the corresponding pain and adventure and suffer. And this is what the Odyssey is about.
The books we are going to see all handle the problem of individuation, because they all have the starting point that you mentioned. In Quixote, it is when he loses his library, it goes into his mind, he memorizes, and he goes into action. With Dante is the exile from Florence. That's when he starts to be on the road, but also on the spiritual road. With Hamlet, it's when he comes home that he only then starts to ask himself, who am I, and so on. So I think it's very useful what you have told us, this idea of both the itineration and the concentration, so that in the middle is the possibility of individuation.
Yes.
You think that Ulysses, do you think that Odysseus, Ulysses, ever comes to know who he is?
Well, again, not as a static position, but certainly he is much more developed and much more wiser, and I think that is the genius of the Odyssey, that it has survived all these thousands of years and across, you know, so many cultures, etc., because it has this the subtlety, and it doesn't have the what I would say the barbaric linearity that we have now in the 20th century, 21st century. You know, sort of, you came from there, you hear, you know, barbaric linearity in terms of geography and in terms of time, etc., etc. The time goes in and out all the time, the places go in and out, etc. And in that we see very subtle things of that Odysseus develops. For example, now you mentioned that, I can think of a small thing that, you know, with all the, well, I don't claim to be a classic scholar, although I've studied a lot of that. I don't think I've come across that anywhere else. It's this: when he goes in the underworld, it's a very powerful scene when he moves, finds his mother.
Yeah.
He didn't know she was dead.
But if I'll talk there. To you later, I want to look at Tiresias.
Yeah, well, the point I want to make is this. He tries to embrace her three times and he cannot, etc. And then he's asking her about what happened. And just look at this. He's asking her, what happened to my father, my son, and my wife? Just look at this. My father, my son, and my wife. She replies, what happens to his wife, his son, and his father? In other words, she reverses the order that he goes with one perception and he gets something else. Yeah. Tiny things like that.
Yes.
So, you know, his priorities, his father, his son, his wife, she changes it. And he sees things differently. So these are the subtle things. These are not, you know, Hollywood cinema scope things that flash clearly to, you know, these are subtle things that we see in Odysseus always. And we need to actually struggle to find the transformation. There isn't any kind of, at the beginning he's this and at the end is that.
No.
There are subtle things everywhere. And I think this is what is the richness of the Odyssey that helps us to understand and to value.
Another detail, since you're pointing out these small details, when he is in the land of the dead and he speaks to Achilles, and he speaks to Achilles in terms of heroics, which somehow applies to him, Achilles says, I'm not interested. I will put everything away. I will be a slave if I were alive. Compared to death, nothing is worth it. And that is huge for this man who is presented as a hero.
Exactly. And in fact, just carrying on from what you're saying, I love talking with you. What is his mother's name? Yeah. His mother's name is Anticlea, yes. Anticleos, against yes. fame and yes. and fame and glory and renown. Completely the opposite.
Yes.
So, you know, he goes there puffed up and all of that, and he encounters his mother. He cannot connect with her, yeah. but he's connecting with Anticlea, with the yeah. opposite of what he has been following. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there are, the subtleties are everywhere. I mean, at the beginning we mentioned, so not to add too many more things to complicate the audience, when we talked about the feigning madness at the beginning, what is mm-hmm. he doing? He's sowing salt
yes.
instead of grain.
He's grain. Sowing salt. Yeah. yeah.
But salt is sea. That's where yes. he's going to spend most of his time.
I didn't notice that. That's a brilliant detail, Reynolds. Yes.
And I mean, there is another one. And talking about that. Or Tiresias is talking to him about when he's going to die.
Yes.
And then it's a very famous thing that it's debated by classicists. There is ex alos. And that is there are at least three interpretations of that. Outside the sea, in other words, you're not going to die
yes.
in the sea.
Yes.
Or it is from the sea. Either yes. outside or from.
Yes, yes.
In other words, you are going to die yes. because you are going yes. to be in the sea. Or exalos also means frantic, and you are going to be go berserk. And in other words, you are going to go mad, and you yes. are going to die from that.
Right.
So the word exalos right. that Tiresias says to him, you are going to die from,
yes.
It has three different meanings, which again yes. helps us to grow in that and explore ourselves rather than, you know, like the books in airport loungers yeah. that tell you what you should be doing with your life.
Yes.
Well, so that's individuation, to grow in that space with our own struggle rather than expecting a recipe,
yes.
which is the, you know, the whole of the mental health field today. If you are troubled, do this, do that, regardless of who the human being is.
Yes.
I mean, that is so crude, that is so anti-Odyssean.
Anti-literature, because literature is always in that ambiguity. I, hearing you speak, I can't help to wonder yet again at the genius of Dante, who without having read the Odyssey, suspects yeah. this in Ulysses, but also takes it from Virgil, this idea that the souls cannot embrace. It's so moving. Two of the most moving scenes in the Commedia are when Statius wants to embrace Virgil. it's so moving, but he didn't read Homer, and Homer was the one who came up with this. Because it's the idea that, once again, if you are trying to find who you are, you cannot count on the dead. You cannot count on your memories. You cannot embrace it. They're not concrete. And to go back to the involuntary dislocation, the involuntary dislocated cannot embrace the memories of what he left. They are not concrete. So what do you do with that? How do you hold on to them but not consider them material and find material things to concrete your place?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Alberto. I'm going back to the space, creating a space between them and us, so that can be co-created, for us to facilitate that and not to give them anything concrete. The alternative, you may remember that in my book, when I did some research, I came up with that with Immanuel Kant,
yes.
who is talking about, I'm mentioning this in order to answer your question. He is saying, in the anthropology from a pragmatic point of view, he's arguing, Immanuel Kant, that the homesickness of the people from rural places is stronger because the urban people are busy making money. And then they cannot think about their homes back. And so the antidote to nostalgia, in a sense, is make money. And as we may know, I don't know, I found that, I cannot pronounce that very well, but Michel Guillaume Jean de Crèvecoeur, who in 1781, wrote his letters from of an American farmer. He's French, he's in America, and he's telling everybody how wonderful America is.
Yes.
And basically it's the land of plenty, come here and you will prosper and all of that and all of that and all of that. And that is identified as the development of the American dream. The American dream, the idea is that forget about nostalgic things and all of that. Get on, make money, get a better house, get a second house, get a fat bank account and all of that. And then that will cure you of any homesickness. And the idea is that, you know, they are playing on the Latin saying, patria ubi bene, or ubi panis ibi patria, wherever there is your bread is your country, or wherever is good is your country. So it's turning. So the over concreteness of get on integration. I'm not against that. I'm not against, but I'm saying if that is done in a crude way, as an antidote to nostalgia, and we deprive human beings of their own right to struggle with their nostalgia. Because in their struggle with nostalgia, they will develop themselves. Now, the difficulty is that people are too quick to go quickly and sort of put a band-aid and sort of stop feeling any pain. But pain is part of human beings to discover in their road to individuation the uniqueness of their own being and enhance it and deepen it. And this is my concern, that this over concreteness and try to say, get involved with something, you know, make money, make a new life here and forget all of that, is depriving human beings of their own, not just simply complexity, of important parts of themselves and of important questions and quests that every human being needs to go through in order to develop themselves as human beings and arrive at their uniqueness of their home, which of course we know is never a static position, but is always an ongoing quest, including a lot of joy, but also a lot of pain. And we don't have that complexity of understanding now. We want to put a band-aid and stop it and say, job done, tick, next.
But Homer was more intelligent, because when Odysseus hears Demodocus sing of his actions at Troy, he starts to weep. And Antinous doesn't know who he is, but he sees him weeping and says to the bard, change the subject, sing of something else, sing of Aphrodite and Mars. He doesn't want to put a band-aid on the suffering of his guest, but he wants to allow him the privacy of that suffering.
The last thing you just said is so important. How many of the mental health professionals respect the privacy and the sanctity of people suffering so that they can develop their own meaning, and for us to help them in a meaningful way, not imposing, not depriving them of that, but creating respectfully that space for them. This is my difficulty with the psychology of immigrants and all everybody wants to help and you know yeah. They want to put band-aids. Yes, yeah. That is also needed. But at some stage, then a little bit later, we need to help people to connect with their pain so that they can develop and transform. That's why I'm saying in this field, there are two languages. The language, what I call the damage and repair. And yes, people are damaged and certain things need to be repaired. But also there is the other language, which I call of the incomprehensibility, poetic incomprehensibility, because and we need to validate that so that we can, in other words, people ask awkward questions. These questions are not awkward, these are philosophical, existential questions. If we want to talk about their trauma, they will talk about their trauma. But if we create space, every human being that I work with, they will ask questions that I call philosophical questions or existential questions. Why did this happen to me? Mm-hmm. What is the nature of human beings? Mm-hmm. Why is there so much suffering in the world? Mm-hmm. Now, we're so crude, we expect answers to this. No, what is important is to engage with these questions.
And we have to read the...
By engaging with these questions.
We have to read the book of Job.
And many more.
And many more. Especially the book of Job, because yes. Those questions are asked and God does not give an answer.
And that is that respect. And this is my concern. Can we genuinely respect human beings, or do we need to pathologize them and put them in a certain box so that we can help them, mm-hmm. so that they can fit into the boxes of our own health system or care system? Mm-hmm. And that's the concern, because in effect, sometimes I call that, you know, positive dehumanization. They are dehumanized by the aggressors, mm-hmm. whatever happened in their countries. But in effect, we're also dehumanizing them by depriving them of this unique opportunity to engage with these struggles to make sense of these issues in life. And of course, we cannot offer them, you know, some therapists play gurus. We should not offer them answers, but we should validate the questions and create appropriate space, sacred space for them to develop that ability and stamina to see things through so that they can arrive at their own odyssey and not just simply follow recipes that are written by smart psychologists in various Western countries.
This space of ambiguity is a wonderful definition of literature. Thank you. Thank you very much, Reynos. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.